Hello, hello to the podcast Agroecology World and this 13th episode. Once again, this is your host, Rob Clouson, a.k.a. Dr. K. And I want to personally welcome you and thank you for your interest in learning about global agroecology-based efforts to achieve the promises of sustainable food systems. I sincerely believe that it will bring you inspiring ideas and connections from around the world that you can use in your efforts in your communities. I want to get started with a little podcast housekeeping by briefly describing my background and the goals of the podcast Agroecology World, especially for any new listeners. My professional career includes tenure as a university extension faculty in sustainable agriculture and natural resources at the University of Florida Institute of Food and Agriculture Sciences, where my educational programs included agroecology, sustainable and urban agriculture, and regional biodiversity conservation and natural history. The podcast Agroecology World brings to you my conversations with some of the outstanding practitioners and communities that are implementing programs based on agroecology and or related holistic agriculture movements for sustainable food systems development that I am so lucky to meet during my current world travels with my wife, Skye, after my retirement in 2018. In a nutshell, my intent for Agroecology World is to let you meet and hear from actual folks and places so that you can learn directly from their own ideas and experiences. And as usual, I will keep it informal but informative and light but enlightening. I'm so pleased to offer you this episode number 13 for a couple reasons. First, it serves as a follow-up to the content of my last episodes number 11 and 12 about the agroecology scene in Ireland where we are now living. If you have not already listened to these episodes, I highly encourage you to do so, to hear these initial explorations of examples of community-based actions for sustainable food systems. Second, it expands my exploration of the potential of agroecology as a transdisciplinary approach that includes input across three major sources: scientific disciplines, traditions of agriculture practices, and social movements. This episode will explore some opportunities offered by the social movements of agroecology, specifically community-based food policies and food policy councils. This theme is taking on paramount importance and relevance to communities everywhere today, as the fragility of our food systems and vulnerabilities of large portions of urban and rural populations, as well as worldwide biodiversity, are more and more self-evident in this era of COVID pandemic and climate change emergency. For this episode number 13, I was very fortunate to interview Colin Sage of the Cork Food Policy Council in Cork, Ireland. I talked to him about the history, mission, activities, and accomplishments of the Cork Food Policy Council and his role as its founding chair. I know that you will find Dr. Sage's words and perspectives very informative and useful. Before we get to the interview, I would like to provide the following background information on today's topic for your consideration. The policies at all government levels, for example, local, municipal, and national, determine to a considerable degree the institutions, programs, and regulations that shape our agriculture and food systems. A food policy can be as broad as a national program of food assistance in response to hunger in society, or as local as a zoning law that allows residential backyard chicken keeping. In a perfect world, these policies would ensure long-term sustainable goals, such as all people having access to safe, affordable, healthy foods, conservation of the natural resources and biodiversity that are the foundations of agriculture productivity. Providing a quality of life for farmers as well as farm and food workers. Supporting a resilient local food economy. And upholding high standards of a farm animal welfare. As communities everywhere are realizing, however, many food policies are inadequate and come up short of such goals, serving instead only short-term and special interest objectives. At the same time, these policy shortcomings can provide opportunities for change and new policy development. For over 50 years, academic experts and food activists have been highlighting that food systems are vast, touching many different aspects of society and require many interrelated policies to address urgent issues. To this end, the concept of the community food system is now commonly accepted and is defined as recognizing the direct and indirect levels of a food system. For example, there's the direct level of a food system called the food chain, as in food production, processing, distribution, retailing, consumption, and waste. Then there's the indirect level of those societal sectors impacted by the food chain, such as jobs, economic development, culture, public health, community viability, farmland protection, and environmental stewardship. Consequently, with this expanded perspective of a food system, the diversity of stakeholders is also larger. For example, at the direct level, there are the different participants of the food chain, including farmers, allied agriculture industries, food entrepreneurs, processors, distributors, retailers, and consumers. At the indirect level, we can identify other stakeholders, including community advocates, trade associations, funders and lenders, technical service providers, educators and researchers, land planners, government agencies, elected officials, and policymakers. The social movements that are part of agroecology promote various political approaches of action to correct the inadequacies of policies at all levels affecting the community goals of a food system. These include issues such as food justice, food security, food sovereignty, resilience, food culture, and sustainability. This development is described as transformative agroecology. One example of political action is the formation of a food policy council. Here, the basic idea is to organize stakeholders of a community food system for critically examining its strengths and weaknesses and constructing recommendations for a system that reflects their values. Food policy councils can come in different organization sizes and structures and address different policy issues. Food policy councils strive to give stakeholders a voice in a political system of food democracy. As explained in past episodes, the concepts and principles of agroecology are derived from and depend on the involvement of a diversity of stakeholders. This fact is also very true for an effective food policy council that hopes to highlight and champion the needs of a community food system with an integrated approach to achieving its goals. Next, we will listen to my conversation with Colin Sage of the Cork Food Policy Council. As an introduction, here's a partial summary of Colin's background. Dr. Sage had a career as an academic senior lecturer of the School of Human Environment, Department of Geography, University College Cork, Ireland. He has produced numerous publications on different aspects of food systems, including such topics as food justice, food policy, and food security, both in global and local Irish food systems. In 2012, he published the influential book Environment and Food, and in 2014, he co-edited the book Food Transgressions, Making Sense of Contemporary Food Politics. And in 2020, he co-edited the book Food System Transformations, Social Movements, Local Economies, and Collaborative Networks. He was the founding chair of the Cork Food Policy Council, the first food policy council in Ireland. It was formed along with local community stakeholders in 2012. This interview with Colin took place in February 2021. Welcome you, Colin Sage. I'm glad that you could have this time to talk with me about your role and the role of the Cork Food Policy Council in helping produce a more sustainable food system for County Cork, City Cork. But I know you have both academic and personal interests globally for this topic. And one thing that I hope that we can talk about is how not only the chronology of the Cork Food Policy Council, but kind of how you were able to bring the holistic perspective that you've had as much as I've read in some of your writings to the Cork Food Policy Council as a model for other communities to think about how they can possibly bring that resource to their community when they start really addressing and wanting to make their food system more sustainable and resilient. So I'll just let you introduce yourself and help us get started.
Okay, well, thanks, Robert, for the invitation to speak with you today. I was in Cork for over 20 years and working as an academic at University College Cork. And more latterly, as well, involved in as chair of the Cork Food Policy Council. So I suppose the work of kind of developing and working with others to develop a food policy initiative in Cork really seemed to be the natural progression, I suppose, of my work, my academic work, tied, I suppose, with a kind of an implicit engaged sense of action, you know. So I've never really been a pure scholar in the sense of wanting only to spend my time writing research papers without also wanting to make a difference outside the academy. So I suppose that's where that came from. But I mean, just to the context is that, you know, I had worked for a long period of time in countries of the South. I worked in Bolivia for 3 years, did some work in Indonesia, did some work in Mexico, was involved in food security evaluations in Ethiopia, Pakistan, Central America. So I had a kind of good background of experience of working overseas and looking at the relationship. I suppose this is what that experience gave me, was to understand something about the way that people fashion their immediate natural surroundings, their environments, if you like, to be able to secure their food supply. So I suppose I was always interested in the issue of the relationship between environment and food and how people, you know, manage those resources in order to produce sufficient nutrition for themselves and their families. But I suppose I felt increasingly that I was, no longer really needed in countries of the South. There are so many able people working in their own countries that don't need gringos to come in and explain things to them. So when I moved to Ireland with my young family back in 1997, it seemed a good moment really to reset and to rethink things and activities. And actually Ireland was an interesting moment then in terms of the emergence of a new artisan food movement. So I became quite kind of attracted to working with some of those people who were, heroic individuals, some of them, because they were not only trying to produce food locally on their own bits of often very poor land, farmland, but doing so, I think, in the face of what I regarded as an almost hostile state. So the food regulations of the time and the sort of hygiene regulations, food safety regulations, were often quite stringent, often applied quite stringently to artisan food producers, more so than I thought to the mainstream food producers. So I got quite involved with working with cheesemakers most especially, and was involved in helping to establish the Irish Raw Cow's Milk Cheese Presidium, which was basically working with raw cow's milk cheesemakers. So in other words, unpasteurized milk, which was always facing the most, you know, difficult circumstances, because the state was often of the view that this was a poison that was ready to kind of wipe out the whole population. But, you know, we know that, of course, not only does unpasteurized cow's milk have, you know, some really, you know, important nutritional properties, it also produces fabulous cheese, as we know, you know, from across Europe. So anyway, so I was involved in that work for a while, and you know, I suppose bringing it together inside some of the writing that I was doing, published the book Environment and Food, which I wrote which came out in 2012, and you know, and then I suppose then there was a moment of really rethinking a little bit what was happening. And there was, I think, quite an interesting growth of interest in cities and how do cities become more responsible for their own food supply. And I've been involved peripherally in a project in Knocknaheeny on the north side of Cork City, a community food initiative. I was asked to just be a part of the board and, you know, have a look at what was going on. And it was an extremely productive project, a very, very exciting project. And when that came to an end at the finish of 2012, I think we thought this was a good opportunity to say, let's see if we can't do something that will take us, you know, across Cork City as a whole. And so that's where the ideas first were founded, about creating a food policy council for Cork.
And very interesting. I know you and I have a lot of parallels in our career. We had extension career in Florida, we were working, well, we have a small farmers program, and we had to help them lobby our Department of Agriculture, State Department of Agriculture, to allow what we call cottage foods, equivalent to artisan foods, because up until then, you know, you had to have a certified kitchen and a lot of overhead expenses to be able to produce food that you could sell to the public. And it's still an ongoing process with the regulators. Like you say, everybody wants food safety, but at the same time, we don't want to exclude those innovators, those food entrepreneurs that are what the public is looking for these days. It's very, the trend, I think global now, is to continue to want to support more local sources of food, and for a variety of reasons. And And those are, that's the challenge that we have. How do you make that happen? And we too reached to the conclusion that policy was an area that it's not the only way to make change happen, but it's definitely part of being, you could call it being a food citizen or food democracy. It was a very interesting exercise for us to do as well. So when it became obvious that a Cork Food Policy Council might be the next stage, curious to know, you may have recognized the need in your closest associates. How did you get that awareness out to the greater community so that then you have a coalition of stakeholders that can go forward to try to actually make some significant changes?
Yeah. This is a kind of an interesting process. And in fact, we've just published a paper in the journal Food Policy, which has just appeared, which explores all of this. It's around the idea of policy entrepreneurship and food champions and how you kind of create the circumstances around which to build, if you like, some kind of coalition around which to effect some kind of local policy change in support of more sustainable food systems. So in the case of the Cork Food Policy Council, as I say, it came out of the Knocknaheeny project in many ways. And I suppose the most important person that I worked with was a woman, Denise Cahill, who's the coordinator of the Cork Healthy Cities project. And so the Cork Healthy Cities is ostensibly, it's a WHO initiative set across Europe in which cities apply to become designated as healthy cities. That's not to say they have become certified as healthy cities. It's just that they are working towards a process of becoming healthier cities. And of course, it covers a whole range of things, you know, weight reduction, smoking cessation, exercise. There's a whole set of obviously healthy indicators that need to be addressed. But clearly food is fundamental in there. And so with Denise and with Catherine Harford from Niche, who had been the coordinator of the project in Knocknaheeny. I suppose the three of us really kind of put our heads together, and we drew in people really on a very deliberative kind of basis. It wasn't wildly democratic. It was very kind of selective in the sense we thought we could do with someone, you know, we brought in obviously the Cork Environmental Forum, and then there were other people, fellow travellers, if you like, that we knew. We needed people from the restaurant sector, if you like, from food retailing. And in fact, we've always had quite a good relationship with Musgraves, who are the, you know, owners of the Supervalue and Centra range of supermarkets and convenience stores. But they are Cork-based. They are Irish. They're not a foreign multinationals selling us food. So it seemed appropriate to kind of find a way to also bring them into the table. And so in some ways, it was a quite deliberate process of selecting people that we thought had something to offer. And when we sort of started things really in 2013, that process really began by then seeing, do we have a set of principles? Food aspirations, if you like, that we could work with. So we created a food charter, which we could say made up of five things. I mean, you know, a more sustainable food system, whatever. It's all motherhood and apple pie kind of aspirations. But of course, what it does brings them together in a concrete form, and it was surprising the degree to which I suppose many people hadn't really thought of food in this way, talking about sustainability in relation to our food supply. And of course, what we wanted to do is then see if we could find ways of working with the city council. And we did have some early success, largely through the director of community and environment, who had joined us. And so through 2013, we began that process of talking, of just thinking through, I suppose, the process of formulating something. And then 2014, Patrick's Day weekend of 2014, we held our launch event, which was a pretty big event that we held on the Grand Parade in the middle of Cork City on the Saturday of the Patrick's weekend, and we had secured over a ton of vegetables that were about to be thrown away, that were going into landfill, and we rescued those vegetables. We had them brought down to CIT, to the Cork Institute of Technology, where there's a culinary arts program, and they got 100 students to work on chopping up, prepping these vegetables. And then we had we brought in some friends from London who had the these cooking pots that we could lay our hands on, and we cooked a meal was cooked for 5,000 people from what was discarded waste vegetables, so a curry that was prepared. And we had queues of people stretching all the way along the Grand Parade, waiting for the feeding time. So we handed out a free lunch, which also consisted of other things that we managed to secure. And we had other events going on, a cookery demonstration, stalls, lectures, and so on. So it was a real spectacle happening that day. That, I suppose, brought us into the public domain much more, created visibility for what the Food Policy Council was about. I suppose the issue then was to follow up and to take it forward from there.
And I'm curious, now, in the original form of the Cork Food Policy Council, was there any official status given to it to legitimize you raising these issues? You know, I think that's a significant variable of all food policy councils. Sometimes they're grassroots, sometimes they're actually officially sanctioned. And for your your experience, was that a factor that contributed or inhibited your ability to form this coalition?
Well, I mean, this is, I think you put your finger on the nub of the issue here, because a food policy council really wants to set some sort of an agenda, but it needs to do that in collaboration with local policymakers. So it wants policymakers to pay attention, but it doesn't want to be under the remit of the city council, so that it doesn't have very much room for maneuver. What a policy council needs above all, of course, is some finance. Needs just enough in order to support perhaps a coordinator, ideally a full-time coordinator. Our relationship with the city council, I have to say, has been ambivalent. We've enjoyed some really good relationships with one or two far-sighted individuals, but I have to say that Cork City Council, it could be argued that it's changing a little bit. It's beginning to understand, I suppose, what the Food Policy Council is about and what many of these civic initiatives are about. But the problem with the City Council, as many other municipal authorities, is that they tend to be very bureaucratic. They're very siloized in terms of their departmental briefs. They don't really have any vision that stretches across departments. You know, this is planning, this is environment, this is, you know, community action, this is health, this is, you know, and they don't see any possibility for joined up thinking in these regards. They're also entirely short term. They're working on very short term horizons. And you could say that's largely because they're underfunded, because they don't have significant funds to do anything outside the mainstream. So I suppose I could say I was was often quite disappointed by the response from the higher echelons of the city council. even though people on, you know, that were on the ground were quite good and quite engaged and so on. And that relationship goes on. I mean, there's a, as I say, it's a sort of an arm's length relationship in some ways. And all you can do is work and lobby and see if you can't, you know, affect some change. I mean, we made a, we've made a number of proposals to the city council, including the, during the preparation of the city development plan for 2015-2021. And, you know, some proposals that we made were accepted, you know, growing, increasing the area, growing space in the city. Some proposals were not accepted. So, you know, that's all you can do is lobby and promote your vision of a of what is a more sustainable food system. I'd say the city council was beginning to understand the value of these kinds of agendas. But I mean, you do, it does mean that you're working hard, banging your head against the door often a few times before they wake up and listen.
Very interesting. Well, I know I can also say that I think with the diverse community of stakeholders that we were able to put together for a food policy council, there was a learning curve for a lot of those organizations. Now, someone like yourself with experience and a perspective of a multitude of issues that can be brought into what is a resilient food system. Not all, like you were saying, the city council itself, certain individuals have that perspective before others. Whether or not they're the ones that make the final decision or not, that's, you know, there's a time factor involved where you bring on more and more groups to your coalition because you're trying to address more and more issues. Did Cork Food Policy Council have a strategy? If your first, sounds like your first partner was the health, health initiative, to then how to bring in the producers, how to bring in the some outlets, you know, the different layers of the food system, so that the Food Policy Council can claim to represent a very diverse swath of stakeholders. To raise a multitude of important issues that should be looked at, even though maybe not initially understood as completely as you'd want them to. So just kind of curious on how you've in the beginning recognized or identified certain groups that may not have started coming to your meetings, and you were trying to recruit them to become part of the efforts.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of, we had an organic grower involved from the very beginning, but she had to step away about a year or so in because of the demands on the farm. And I suppose we've often been, we've not really, well, we haven't, because I can't speak for the current formulation of the city, of the Food Policy Council. But I suppose finding producers that have an attitude of, you know, positive engagement. In the fact of the matter is County Cork is dominated by dairy and, you know, commodity agriculture. And many of the smaller specialty food producers are, you know, are involved in producing very high quality foods, but for a more, if you like, upmarket clientele. And I suppose we've always found it a bit of a struggle in terms of trying to, and of course there are people that are working often 24/7 in keeping their small businesses going. And don't have time to attend meetings and so on. So there are issues there about that. But otherwise, I think we felt that we had a reasonable cross section of people that were attending meetings, and we were trying to broaden out and expand. I suppose the key thing when you mention strategy is, what do we focus on? I suppose one of the key elements that we worked with was to inevitably, I suppose we became much more focused on the city rather than the county, despite numerous efforts. Even if we had an ambivalent relationship with the city council, the county council had no interest at all in collaborating with us. I mean, they had been a complete and utter waste of time, called county council, in terms of seeing, I suppose, the potential for a wider policy initiative across the city region. So I suppose, given that we were looking at the city, and one of the things that we did develop was, I suppose, a particular interest in urban agriculture, because we felt that there was a strong, you know, interest in growing things in the city. And one of the things that we developed was that in 2015, we had a public meeting to see how we go forward. And a lot of people turned up, and really it became an opportunity to sort of think through what would it look like if we started a process of guerrilla planting, putting planter boxes around town. And so a strategy was devised for using the historic spine of the city, so stretching from Barrett Street all the way across North Main Street, South Main Street, and up to Shandon, with planter boxes. Now, some areas were better attended than others, but we, you know, a big bunch of people, we were involved in making those planter boxes, painting them up, planting them up with food plants. There's an initiative in Yorkshire, in West Yorkshire, in the UK, in a place called Todmorden. It's called Incredible Edible Todmorden. And the Incredible Edible model is to basically do guerrilla planting, plant things up, and encourage people to take food away and eat it, basically. So it's just help yourself. We did that, and I think what was surprising was there was absolutely no messing around with those boxes. People took some leaves, took them away, herbs or salad leaves and so on, and ate them. But there was no degradation of those boxes. And about a year later, we had a conversation with one of the people from the city council who said, would you be interested in taking over some space in the inner city? And from there, in fact, what happened was that there was a disused open-air basketball court that had been locked up because of antisocial behavior for years and years. And so the Food Policy Council had a look and decided that it would take it over. The city council wasn't prepared to put in anything, power or water. They said, this is how it is. You can't lift the tarmac, which is down there. You have to take it as it is, use the asphalt if you want to use it. And so that became the St. Stephen's Sustainable Food Lab, which exists to this day. And it's kind of now run by a cooperative of about 25 people who basically, you know, grow things in planter boxes on the surface. And because underneath that tarmac is supposed to have been a Huguenot a cemetery going back into the 17th century. So there's probably no end of things down there. But so that became a sort of springboard, if you like, for thinking about growing spaces in the South Parish. And so there is a big project, a project goes on today, a greening, this urban greening project, which is focused a lot on the South Parish. So, you know, what has happened, I suppose, is from those first initiatives, is it gives rise to it's a springboard to other activities that take off. Whether it's urban greening, you know, just trying to improve the quality of the lived environment by putting in even ornamental plants, but just to kind of improve the quality of the urban environment. And I suppose we proceeded on the basis of a law that we think, which was very effective, is never ask permission to do anything, but always to apologize afterwards if you're caught out. And that was the thing, you know, just do it and then see what happens. And if you get a smack across the wrists, you can always, you know, deconstruct something if necessary But that's never happened. And so we kind of proceeded on that basis.
Well, I did have a chance to look at that submission about urban agriculture. And again, so many of the issues that you were looking at, so similar to what, in my experience, you had to try to come up with either, like you say, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness approach, or try to educate the regulators about just how much of an obstacle that was. So one of them that I remember reading about was some sort of coordination about land access and land availability for community gardens or just growing space. That was a big gap that wasn't available to people. The other one was asking the city council to be supportive of urban market gardening, a commercial side to it, in addition to the more social community gardening approach. Both have benefits that can definitely improve quality of life in a city. And, you know, I'm not too sure, like you say, some of your proposals were acted on, some weren't. How did that report fare in terms of the city responding to some of those suggestions?
Well, one of the suggestions that we made, for example, was one of the key things I think that has come to it's not a very powerful issue, but I think it's been particularly by food policy people have been concerned with the proximity of fast food restaurants close to schools, and there was a moment when we thought we should really press the case for what has been kind of colloquially called no fry zones around schools. So taking the idea of a no fly zone, you know, that NATO used to use in Libya and so on. And a no fry zone would be some sort of sterile zone around a school, assuming that schools were trying to teach good nutrition to their pupils, whether of primary or secondary level. But often, of course, the things that we hadn't done well in Ireland, I think, are school dinners. And often, you know, particularly at secondary level, pupils leave, students leave the school gates and go down to the chipper and eat a chipper, chips and burger or pizza for their lunch. And I suppose this idea that there was too many fast food options available to them close to schools was something that we thought ought to be addressed through the planning lens. So in other words, it was an really within the remit of the city council to utilize planning regulations to restrict the availability of fast food close to schools. Well, that idea was thrown, I mean, they didn't want that at all. What was interesting, there is an interesting story about that, was that after the launch event in 2014, I did a follow-up interview with a journalist from the Evening Echo, the Cork evening newspaper, and I was asked, well, you know, what do you do next? Where do you go from here after the success of the launch event and so on? And I don't remember what I said, but somehow, you know, there were a few various policy options that we hoped the city council might look at, including this idea of a no-fry zone around schools, that, you know, could this be something that we could consider? Well, what was interesting was that 2 days later, on the front page of the Evening Echo, it suggested that all chippers were going to be closed down by this new food policy council in Cork. Which, of course, you know, was far from the truth, but it made for a very interesting headline. And then, of course, a follow-up on all the radio stations, you know, as people were, you know, furious with this idea that, you know, suddenly their chips were going to be prohibited. But actually, what was also interesting was that the Irish Independent picked up, it just goes to show, journalists don't look too far for their stories sometimes. They look at the provincial newspapers. And an Irish independent, national Irish independent journalist obviously spotted this on the front page of The Echo, and then ran a front page or a page three headline saying proposal to, you know, to restrict the availability of fast food close to schools. And then it went then to the Minister of for Children at the time, who's now in the European Parliament, and asked the minister, well, so what's the department doing about this? You know, given that this is such an important thing. And of course the department said, oh, well, we're really studying this. We're really looking at all the policy options available to improve the quality of food available to our young people and so on. Of course they weren't at all. But it demonstrated the power of a civil society organization to put something on the table and to kind of have it really explored as an idea, you know, with media as well, obviously using it to leverage that up into public attention. But like most media things, we just didn't have the capacity to run with this, because it would have needed a lot of activity to have taken this forward. And I'm still running a full-time job at this stage in the university, and you know, and so it became quite difficult to take that forward as an issue, and of course it fell away. But it does suggest there are windows of opportunity where civil society organizations can bring these issues to wider public attention.
Yes, definitely, indeed. You know, one aspect that I'm very curious about is the impact of the Cork Food Policy Council on country, the Republic of Ireland, you know, other cities or communities that have seen what has been going on in Cork and have thought of bringing it to their community. What level of that is happening, but also in the bigger picture in the European Union, Your example about the eating fries made me think about the controversy or the hopes for the Green Deal in all of the EU. And one of the key parts of that, of those proposals, is looking at what you might call a more sustainable diet and what kind of changes people would be asked to do to help bring about a more sustainable food system wherever they are in the EU. And so just thinking about linkages on a larger scale, has Cork Food Policy Council seen where they've had an impact, or are they drawing inspiration from other activities going on?
Well, so one of the things that we became involved with early on was in the UK, there's a Sustainable Food Cities Network. Now, the Sustainable Food Cities Network in the UK also benefits from lottery funding. So it's been able to really support many of the new initiatives that have developed across some of the UK cities. And so they have a really vibrant network of about, I suppose, around 50 cities now and 50 city regions, let's say, where cities are engaged to some degree or another in rolling out sustainable food strategy for their areas. And obviously that would reflect also a difference in terms of the collaboration with local authorities. Some would be working closely with local authorities, more progressive local authorities. Some local authorities are probably a bit more backward in terms of their approach. So we've been a member, if you like, of that network. I did say early on that they couldn't any longer call it the UK Sustainable Food Cities Network if we were a member. But I'm not sure now of the stage of our collaboration with them, because we were the only city that was outside the UK, and obviously we fell outside of the opportunities for funding from that. So within Ireland, I suppose there have been one or two examples of where people have looked towards us and thought, is there some way we can help? And I suppose the best collaboration we've had, or at least the best dialogue, has been with Galway. So I've been up to Galway and spoken with people. I know Denise Cahill, the coordinator of the Healthy Cities, has spoken with colleagues in Galway too. And the Healthy Cities agenda can often be a useful way of grounding that within the local authority as well. But actually, no, there's not been very much, I suppose, effort to replicate the Cork experience. Mind, I have to say that this idea of building a food policy initiative or network or association or council, whatever you want to call it, isn't something that should be regarded as a blueprint. You can't simply say, oh, they've done it in Cork, we'll do the same thing here. It has to really reflect the specific local circumstances and the resources that you have available, the kind of dynamics, if you like, of different actors and civil society organizations that are operating in that area. As far as I'm aware, the Cork Food Policy Council still remains the only one of its kind in the Republic. But we would be hopeful that others would emerge in due course. Your second point, though, was also about what's going on in Europe. And there is a lot going on in Europe. Well, there's a lot going on in the European Commission. There's a lot going on in European cities as well. In the European Commission level, I think one of the interesting developments here with the Green New Deal, also the more specifically related to food, the farm to fork strategy, which is being rolled out and being discussed at the Commission and in the Parliament, of course, is the issue of what is a sustainable diet and how can we encourage citizens to, you know, move towards a sustainable diet. Well, one of the key stumbling blocks here is, of course, meat, especially red meat consumption. And of course, one of the major producers of red meat in the European Union is Ireland. So Ireland has at best an ambivalent attitude towards these debates. Yes, I suppose it likes, you know, it will speak the language of sustainability like all others, not knowing what it really means, you know, because this word is in some way being so badly devalued by the use of, by agribusiness to talk about its operations as sustainable. And so, you know, Irish agriculture and the Irish agri-food industry talks about, you know, sustainable food, but still wants to carry on producing as much meat and dairy as it can. And so it remains an obstacle to effecting, I think, really important change towards a more sustainable diet. Because unless we can square this conundrum of meat and dairy as well, of course, it's going to be really a problem. And that's not to say we all need to become vegetarians or vegans, not at all. But we do have to find a way of probably reducing our meat consumption and probably shifting our consumption from, you know, beef, which is, you know, particularly bad in terms of its greenhouse gas emissions, its climate change implications, towards other forms of meat. And of course, meat substitutes, you know, other proteins, animal protein, non-animal proteins are on the horizon as well. So there's going to be a lot of change, and Irish agri-food is going to have to change with that, with those circumstances, I think. And that's going to be interesting. I think it will bring quite a degree of heat to the debate around how we go forward.
Yes, yeah. And change is not easy for most people and industries. Well, I'm again just want to say how thankful I am. We had some time to talk, and I would like to maybe touch upon kind of it. I know it's going to involve a lot of points we may have already discussed, but here we are in the age of COVID, and I have seen the report that the Cork Food Policy Council put out about COVID being the pandemic era being an opportunity instead of only a threat to food systems. And there's a lot of that kind of discussion going on all around the world.
Yeah.
And from your perspective, how you see food policy councils at the different levels. I mean, we're talking about the Cork Food Policy Council, but you could elevate that up to a national level as well as international. How you see the role of food policy councils to actually help bring about that opportunity to improve on our food systems for so many reasons that, as you know so well, just kind of give us a sense of how you envision the next steps or how communities can see that they have a role through a food policy council to help make it a better world after the pandemic. But we also have climate change. Climate change is an urgency is just as well.
Yeah, well, I think right now the key role is being played not by food policy councils, but by food banks. Food banks are probably more active now than they've ever been. There's more people presenting themselves for emergency charitable relief food supply than ever before. And that reflects the precarity of people's employment, a precarity that existed before the pandemic, but which has been exacerbated by the pandemic. So there are more people living hand to mouth now than ever before. And this is a situation which speaks around social injustice, speaks around the widening gap between, you know, people's incomes and wealth and so on. And there are growing numbers of people who really can't afford to put healthy, nutritious, sustainable food on their tables. And right now, in the height of the pandemic, people are either going hungry or they're turning up at food banks to get emergency relief. Food policy, thinking about sustainable food for them, is simply, you know, some kind of a dream notion. I mean, it has no relevance at all to their lives. And so, you know, that's one thing. On the other hand, of course, where there are resources, where food policy councils or local food initiatives have been better resourced, can draw upon more engaged personnel, volunteers, or even, you know, salaried people and so on, maybe working with city councils, they've been able to work with their collaborators to look at, you know, devising alternative solutions to charitable food provision. And there's a range of things coming out, social supermarkets, sorts of food hubs and so on, where, you know, what we have to find is a way of recovering dignity for people on low or no incomes to get access to food. And frankly, this idea of people turning up and being given a basket of goods, often made up of ultra processed foodstuffs, not fresh vegetables and fruits. And that being, you know, somehow the way of feeding people, I don't think will serve us into the future. I think we have to find a way of recovering a dignified way for people to secure their food supply, even if there is an element of charitable support in there. And I think that's absolutely critical as we go forward. So we need a lot of, thinking around what is a sustainable food system. It's not just a question of producing food with less carbon emissions. It's also about social justice in there. It's also about, you know, ensuring that farmers are paid decent wages and so on, and for their goods. There's a whole set of concerns that we have to factor in, as well as environmental performance, and as well, I think, it's about we're going to have to eat more locally than we've done before, or at least regionally, let's say. And that has all sorts of implications. And I think there's a lot on the case right now, because this year, of course, in September, we'll see the United Nations Summit on food systems, the Food Systems Summit is coming up in September, where there will be a significant discussion around the nature of that. Now, whether that gets hijacked by big agri-food corporations saying we have the solutions, just listen to us and we'll carry on with our genomic redesigned food. I don't know. The other thing that's happening is in November, of course, is the COP26, the Framework Convention on Climate Change, the members, the parties to the convention. And there is a food declaration as part of that that summit, which I think will be very important indeed. The Glasgow Declaration is being formulated. So I think we're going to, certainly hear a lot more about food this year, both as a consequence and as a result of the pandemic, bringing it into sharper relief, and also, of course, as a consequence of our kind of climate catastrophe that we're in. And it will necessarily require us to rethink the food system if we have any hope at all of getting out from underneath this warming curve which we're in. We'll see. We'll see by what the decisions that policymakers make. But I think ultimately there's going to be a groundswell of civil society organizations made up of individuals, concerned citizens, that will come together to put increasing pressure upon policymakers to do the right thing. And let's hope that the progress, which has been started in Washington in January, carries on, I suppose, through this year and is taken up by other governments around the world, and including our own, organization in Brussels and in Europe, which really starts to work upwards in terms of the possibilities for building a more sustainable food system.
Very good. Yeah, I agree with you as well. I like to use the word opportunity instead of threat, because as we understand these issues, they're also interrelated, that when you start to improve one aspect of the food system, you can also make significant improvements on other aspects of society in general. Economic benefits as well as health benefits, it can all be interrelated and go hand in hand if people have that vision. And so helping, one role that I always appreciated about Food Policy Council activities I was involved with was, it's a teaching opportunity for the general public to learn about all of these dimensions and all of these parts of the food system that you may not understand the connections between them all, based on your experience of the food system, you don't realize that something far away is impacting you here. And so that always impressed me as an important role for food policy councils as well.
Yeah.
Well, Colin, again, thanks. Thank you very much for this conversation and your insights. Okay. Yeah. Have a good rest of the day.
Yeah. Thanks, Robert. All the best. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, my conversation with Colin Sage of the Cork Food Policy Council. I sincerely hope that you found it as informative and inspiring as I did, that it gives you food for thought to take back to your community. If you want more information about and or contact the Cork Food Policy Council, you can go to their website at http://CORKFOODPOLICYCOUNCIL www.agroecology.com. If you want more information about and or contact Dr. Sage, you can go to the website of the University College Cork at http://research.ucc.ie/profiles/2001/c.sage@ucc.ie. If you intend to start a food policy council in your community, I would like to recommend the free manual called Doing Food Policy Councils Right by Mark Winnie, which describes the steps in the formation and action plan for a food policy council. It can be downloaded for free at the website www.mark.win.coln/forward/wpdash.content/upload/2012/09/fpc-manual.pdf. If you want online access to global networks of food policy councils and or groups focusing on food policies, you can go to the website of the John Hopkins Center for a Livable Future at http://www.foodpolicynetworks.org/fpc-map/fpc-around-the-world.html, as well as to their Facebook page. The international event called the United Nations Food Systems Summit that was mentioned by Dr. Sage is a current open access online forum that culminates with a summit in September or October 2021. It's self-described as a people's summit and a call to action of every citizen to participate both virtually and in your own community to radically change community food systems to achieve 17 defined sustainability goals. For further information, go to their website at https://www.un.org/en/food-systems-summit. And for information about the Glasgow Food and Climate Declaration of the 2021 COP26 conference, also mentioned by Dr. Sage, you can watch a short video of its launching in December 2020, which is 1 year before the COP26 conference, by going to the website https://youtu.be/JBMEUXJI5hc. Finally, I would like to dedicate this episode in memory of Wayne Roberts, who passed in January 2021. Wayne was a food policy guru and mentor for his home country, Canada, and to so many communities worldwide through the achievements of the Toronto Food Policy Council and his decades thinking, writing, and building networks. I was fortunate to count him as a colleague after meeting him at conferences of the former Community Food Security Coalition. I applied his inspiration and knowledge in my own education programs and facilitations of food policy councils, both at the county and state levels, during my professional career in Florida, USA. So happy trails until we meet again at my next episode of Agroecology World. And again, I appreciate your efforts as an active listener to share the episodes of Agroecology World to your network to promote community action-based actions for sustainable food systems development. Stay safe and stay healthy.